Hello.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Zach.
And together, we are Functionally Literate.
That's right.
Today, we are going to conclude the telling of Book 3 of La Morte d'Arthur. This is the story of the wedding of King Arthur to Queen Guinevere and the forming of the Knights of the Round Table and the adventures that resulted from the feast of the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are in the midst of the first adventure, Sir Gawain, who, if you were listening to the last episode, we wrapped up with Gawain fucking around, killed a lady because he would not give mercy to a knight. This episode, he's going to find out.
Yeah. So what we might get into farther down the line, if we read T.H. White's Once and Future King.
We might.
Which is an Arthurian story.
Yeah.
He does a very interesting characterization of Gawain, where Gawain has this, like, rage issue.
Uh-huh.
Makes sense. He starts fighting, when he gets angry, like, there's no stopping him. And I bring up that characterization because it's so interesting. It kind of, they never explicitly tell you in the Once and Future King that Gawain, about this adventure and that he killed the lady. Mm-hmm. They just continually reference, hey, remember that time you killed a woman? And he's like, I get it, okay? I fucked up. Stop bringing it up. And they're like, never, dude. Never.
Ever,
like,
gonna stop bringing it up.
That's
you did
such
that.
A thing that you did. But he also sort of pairs that characterization with this conflation of the legendary characters of Gawain the Knight and Cú Chulainn, the Celtic mythological hero.
Oh.
Who also had a rage issue.
Oh. Okay.
Because I think that story ends, T.H. White ends it with, like, right before the final battle at the very end of La Morte d'Arthur. And Arthur's, like, telling his whole life story to a page. And he just sends the page away. He's like, you keep that story and you go. And, like, maybe one day people hear this, but just get out of here. Enough people are going to die. You don't need to be here. You're young. Go live your life.
Hmm.
And that page's name was Thomas Malory.
No fucking way.
Yeah.
That's
cool. And, like, and it says as Thomas Malory was leaving, he noticed how odd it was that in English, the name is read Gawain, but in Celtic, that name would probably be pronounced Chulainn.
Hmm.
And it's like, huh.
That is cool.
That's a nice little tie back into Celtic mythology there.
Appreciate that little tidbit. Which, maybe, by the way, yeah, definitely check out the Irish Celtic mythology episode that we did.
Where we talk about Setanta, a.k.a. Cú Chulainn.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, so we just had this guy kill a lady because he would not grant mercy.
He would not accept the surrender.
Now we're moving on to chapter 8.
How four knights fought against Gawain and Gaheris, and how they were overcome and their lives saved at request of four ladies.
So, the narrative wasn't super clear to me about where they fought. Like, I was under the impression that it happened in the Great Hall. But here, at the beginning of this chapter, the story says that Sir Gawain goes back into the castle here. So maybe the Great Hall is actually a walled courtyard where they fought, or maybe the fight with Sir Abelmar just happened outside. I don't know. But
yeah.
So
it's in the location that the hart died.
Yeah.
You know.
So Sir Gawain goes back into the castle with the intention of bedding down for the night. So he starts to disarm himself. And his brother's like, what are you doing? You would be unarmed here? Like, you may have a lot of enemies here. And as soon as Gaheris says this, four knights dressed for battle barge in and come at Sir Gawain hard. You know, they're like, thou new made knight, thou hast shamed thy knighthood, for a knight without mercy is dishonored. Also, thou hast slain a fair lady to thy great shame, to the world's end. And doubt thou not, thou shalt have great need of mercy, or thou depart from us. So I didn't pick up a lot of what they were saying there, but it sounds like they're pissed.
He has shamed himself to the end of the world, meaning there will be no living it down ever.
Ever.
And he, before he escapes them, he will be in need of great mercy, the same mercy he denied the other man.
Yeah. So one of the knights strikes Sir Gawain and he falls to the ground. Gaheris struck at that knight And then one of the knights was an archer, so he hit Sir Gawain with an arrow through his arm. So the brothers likely would have been killed, if not for, in this moment, four ladies who entered the scene, and they beg for the brothers' lives. And so these knights, who did have honor, they relented and instead made the brothers prisoners. So now the brothers behave very sorrowfully. You know, Sir Gawain, he's like, "My arm hurts! I'm likely maimed!" Early the next morning, one of the four ladies that had heard Sir Gawain's complaints about his arm came to him and said, "Sir Knight, what cheer?" So I take this to mean, how are you?
Yes.
Because Sir Gawain's like, not good.
It's like, what's good?
Not
good.
He's
like, nothing.
And she's like, "It's your own fault, for you have done a foul deed by slaying the lady, a villainous thing. But aren't you King Arthur's family?" And he says, "Yes, truly." And she's like, "What is your name? Ye must tell it to me, or ye pass." So does that mean die, or maybe it means like if the conversation's over, if he doesn't say?
In this instance, those are probably the same thing.
Fair enough. So he's like, "My name is Gawain, the son of King Lot of Orkney, and my mother is King Arthur's sister." And she's like, "Ah, then you are King Arthur's nephew. So I shall speak on your behalf to the knights and tell them that you shall be able to go to King Arthur for his love." For his love is another phrase I'm not fully certain about the meaning of. It's like,
just for his goodwill, to make him happy.
Ah, okay.
For the good of Arthur, not Gawain. Right. Like, we're not doing this for you. We're doing it for Arthur.
Yeah. So the lady tells the four knights that the man they imprisoned was Sir Gawain, King Arthur's nephew, son of King Lot, blah, blah, blah. The knights give Gawain the head of the White Hart for the sake of his quests. And then they freed him under the condition that he ride back to Camelot with the dead lady's head hung around his neck and her body across the mane of his horse.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened. He rode that way all the way back to Camelot. Pretty shameful way to ride back home.
Yeah.
And Merlin, being a wizard who can see the future, he tells King Arthur that Sir Gawain must be sworn to tell the full story of his adventures, how he slew the lady and how he would not grant mercy to Sir Ablamar, and how that is why the lady was slain. So before he even gets back, King Arthur already knows.
Yeah.
And Merlin's like, "You make him tell the truth." So he gets back, and that's what happened. You know, Sir Gawain told the full story. You know, he was sworn to do it, so he did. And the king and the queen were very upset by this, justifiably so. And so by order of the queen, a group of ladies were set to judge him. And these ladies, they judged that Sir Gawain must for the rest of his life be on the side of all ladies and to fight for their quarrels, that he should be courteous and never again to refuse mercy to those that ask him for it. This judgment made, Sir Gawain was made to swear on the four evangelists that he should never be against any lady or gentlewoman unless he fought for one lady and his foe fought for another. That was the only condition.
Yep.
Thus endeth the adventure of Sir Gawain that he did at the marriage of King Arthur. Amen. That's how this chapter mm-hmm. ends, which I thought was funny because amen means so be it. It's like this happened.
Yeah. It is poignant and satisfying that Gawain does not show mercy and it results in the death of a woman. And then he is shown mercy by women the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
To really just drive home the point like, hey, you really fucked up, dude.
Which, for the record, my wife was like, they should not have shown him mercy. They should have fucking killed that bitch. He's an asshole. Fuck him.
Yeah. I think they were very noble women for so.
They were.
That is a good thing that they did.
And
regardless
of
the deserving of the person they did it for.
And my wife is not a noble woman. She is a commoner. And she is entitled to her opinions.
Chapter 9. How Sir Tor rode after the knight with the brachet. And of his adventures by the way.
So now we move on to Sir Tor. He readied up, mounted his horse, rode after the hunting dogs. During his travels, this dwarf whacks Sir Tor's horse on the head with a staff.
Perfect.
So the horse backs up a spear length.
totally normal occurrence. Totally. No need to explain how this happened.
No.
Moving on.
So Sartor is like, why did you do that? And then the dwarf is like, thou shalt not pass unless you joust with the knights of the pavilions over there.
That's right.
And sure enough, there were two pavilions, and in each pavilion there was a great spear and a shield that hung on a tree. In both pavilions there was this. And so Sartor is like, I cannot wait. I'm on a quest that I must follow. And the dwarf says again, thou shalt not pass. And he blows his horn. And at the blow of the horn, a knight on horseback came. He equipped his shield, picked up the spear, and then came at Sartor. So Sartor quickly equips his own shield and meets the knight of the pavilion head on. Tor knocked the other knight from his horse, who yielded to Tor, and Tor granted him mercy. But sir, the knight said, I have a fellow in yonder pavilion that will joust you now. And Sir Tor's like, he shall be welcome. And then he sees another knight coming at him with great speed. So they strike at each other, and it was a sight to see, according to the book. The knight struck Sir Tor in the center of his shield so greatly that his spear all to shivered, which, so I take that to mean that Sir Tor's body rattled so much that it made his spear vibrate. Like, that's how hard this guy hit him. Just like,
yeah.
So Sartor struck him, and this is where it gets confusing again for me. Sartor struck him through the shield, below of the shield, that it went through the cost of the knight, but it slew him not. So I'm taking that to mean that Tor's spear hit his shield and glanced downward
underneath
and hit him somewhere below the belt.
Yeah.
That.
But didn't kill him.
Didn't kill him. What do you think?
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So then Sartor strikes him hard on the helm, and the other knight begs mercy. And Sartor's like, I will well, but you and your friend must go to King Arthur and surrender as his prisoners. Who shall we say sent us? The knights say. You shall say by the knight that went in the quest of the knight that went with the brachet. Now, what are your names? So they introduce themselves as Sir Felet of Langduk and Sir Petipace of Winchelsea. Now go you forth, Sir Tor says, and Godspeed you and me. And so they go. And man, it really just goes to show how different of a time this was, because he's just trusting these men to go to King Arthur's court and yield themselves as his prisoners.
Yeah, like 100% they could just not.
They
do that.
Could just not do that, but he's trusting them too. And I'm going to go on a limb and say that they do that because they're honorable knight folk.
Yep.
Yeah,
they do.
So then the dwarf walks up and says to Sir Tor, I pray you give me a gift, which, as we established last episode, means he wants a favor. And so Sir Tor is like, I will well ask. So I will well is a phrase that comes up a lot in this story. Mm-hmm. Does that just mean okay?
It means I will, like, positively, in a good mood. Like, okay. I'm not begrudgingly doing it.
I gotcha.
I'm like, no, I'm happy to help. What's up?
So the dwarf is like, I ask no more but that you will suffer me to do you service, for I will serve no more recreant knights. Recreant meaning cowardly, because he served those two knights, and they suck. So so Sir Tor is like, take a horse and ride on with me. And then the dwarf says, I know you ride after the knight with the white hound, and I shall bring you where he is. So they rode through a forest and then found two more pavilions by a nunnery with a shield in each, and one shield was painted white and the other was red. So that's the setup for the next chapter.
Chapter 10. How Sir Tor found a brachet with a lady, and how a knight assailed him for the said brachet.
So Sir Tor hands the dwarf his glaive, which is kind of like a spear, but it's got a blade on the end rather than a point.
Yep.
So he enters the white pavilion. So there he sees three damsels sleeping on a pallet. And he goes to the red pavilion because the white one didn't have what he was looking for. In the red pavilion, he sees a lady sleeping there as well. But he also sees the brachet there, and it saw him. So the brachet barks at the lady, and the lady and her damsels leave the pavilions. So Sir Tor takes the hound by force, brings it to the dwarf. And then the lady is like, what will you do? Take my brachet from me? And Sir Tor is like, yeah, This brachet I have sought for King Arthur's court. And she's the lady's like,
he said, yeah, it's my dog, bro.
This is my dog now. And she's like, well, you shall not go far with her before someone stops you. And he's like, I shall abide what adventure that comes by the grace of God. And he's not very concerned.
He's like, all right, man.
This is my dog, whatever.
If somebody comes after me, they come after me.
So saying that, he mounts his horse and rides for Camelot. Unfortunately, it was nearly nightfall. So he asked the dwarf if he knew of any lodging nearby. The dwarf did not, but he did know of a hermitage. And he said of it, you must take lodging as you find. So, beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah. There's a hermitage. That's the best we got. Let's go.
So a hermitage is a place where a hermit lives or where people live secluded religious lives. So I think in this case, it means both. I think when hermitages are mentioned in this story, it means both.
It's probably a solitary monk of some kind.
Yeah. So they sought lodging at the hermitage. They ate. They slept. Next morning, mass was held. They have breakfast. They take their leave. Surtur asks that the hermit pray for him. The hermit said he would. Surtur and the dwarf mount horses again and rode for Camelot for a long while. And as they traveled, they heard a knight loudly call after them. This knight's like, knight, abide and yield my brachet that you took from my lady. So Surtur turns and looks at the knight. Knight looked good. Knight looked ready for battle. He was well-armed and armored with a good horse. So Surtur readied himself for battle, and the two knights fought each other hard, and they knocked each other off their horses. They both quickly get back to their feet and, quote, drew their swords as eagerly as lions.
That's right. You know how eagerly lions are with super their swords. They love those swords, those lions. It's crazy.
So they clashed so hard, they sliced the corners off each other's shields. That's how hard they were striking at each other. And blood ran down their helms and their chests, and they wounded each other greatly. But Surtur was the victor. The other knight collapsed, and so Surtur came down on him and demanded he yield. And the knight's like, I will not! By the way, it's in this moment that we learn that the knight's name is Abellius, because the narrative says so. Mm-hmm. He's never introduced as Abellius. It's just in this moment they say his name is Abellius.
Mine says something about, like, and then Abellius said, for that was his name. And it's like,
mine didn't even say for that was his name. It was just like, and then Abellius said, and I had to figure it out from context clues.
Thanks, Thomas.
Yeah, thanks. So, anyway, so this guy's like, I will not, while my life lasts and my soul is in my body, unless you will give me the brachet. And Surtur said, that I will not do, for it was my quest to bring the brachet, you or both.
So this is an interesting dichotomy that we've got between Gawain and Tor.
Yeah.
Gawain battles a knight. The knight begs for mercy. Gawain says no, shames himself forever.
Yeah.
Tor is battling a knight, beats him into submission, and says, ask for mercy.
Yeah.
And the knight says, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right.
Like, he's like, this guy's basically like, I will not yield unless you give me my brachet back. And he's like, no.
Literally can't do that.
I literally cannot do that. I gotta kill you.
Chapter 11. How Surtur overcame the knight and how he lost his head at the request of a lady.
So this chapter is interesting. Like, I like the dynamic here. I don't like the result of it, but I like, it's interesting. So when Surtur declares what his quest is and why he will not yield, a damsel comes riding up on horseback as fast as possible and cries out to Surtur. And Surtur is like, what will you have with me? And the damsel's like, I beg you, for King Arthur's love, give me a gift. I ask you, gentle knight, as you are a gentleman. And Surtur, he considers this, and he's like, ask a gift, and I will give it to you. And she's like, gramercy. As an aside, why gramercy for thank you?
No idea.
And why don't we say that anymore?
You could start it.
I'm not gonna.
All right, maybe I will. We'll see.
Anyway, so gramercy. I ask for the head of the false knight Abellius, for he is the most outrageous knight that lives and the greatest murderer.
Coincidentally, look who we have right here refusing mercy.
Yeah.
It's Abellius.
It's Abellius. And so Surtur is like, I regret agreeing to give you this gift. Let him make amends for the wrong he's done you. And the damsel, she gets haughty. She's like, now he may not, for he slew my own brother before my own eyes. He was a better knight than he, and she gestures at Abellius here, and he had had grace. I kneeled before this one for half an hour in the mire. That's the mud.
Mm-hmm.
She kneeled in the mud for half an hour to spare my brother's life, who had done him no harm and had fought with him by adventure of arms. And for all I could do, he struck off my brother's head. Therefore, I require thee, as you are a true knight, to give me my gift, or else I shall shame thee in all the court of King Arthur, for he is the falsest knight living and a great destroyer of good knights. So Abellius, he hears all this, and he knew he was screwed, and he cries to Surtur, I yield, please have mercy. And Surtur said, I may not now, or I would break my promise and be found false. I would have granted you mercy had you asked for it, but you would not yield unless you had the brachet, and that was my quest. So saying, he took off Abellius' helm and cut off his head.
So in my version, very similar, obviously, but Abellius is like, I'm not going to yield. Lady rides up, says, hey, I want you to actually cut that guy's head off. And he's like, well, I was kind of going to give him mercy. I don't know that I want to do that. And she's like, well, he and my brother were fighting for sport.
Mm.
It was purely just like a fun little contest.
Interesting.
And Abellius happened to win. She begged for the half hour in the mud. Please spare my brother. He said no. Killed him anyway.
Okay.
So it's like even more offensive. This was not, there was no disagreement. There was no difference of opinions here.
He's just like, they were just like, won.
Hey, it's kind of fun to like battle. We should do that. And her brother was like, yeah. And then he killed him.
That's fucked.
For no reason.
For no reason.
And so then, while this is happening, like Abellius hears this and is like, oh, I'm super screwed. And, you know, Tor is like, if only you'd accepted the mercy, I wouldn't have to do this. But I've already told her I would, so I have to now. And he runs off into the woods. Tor chases him. And all it says is, and he came back bearing the knight's head.
That's cooler.
So it's like, we don't know what happened in those woods.
Yeah.
But Tor comes back with, I got him. I got him.
I got it.
But so again, this like this dichotomy between Gawain and Tor.
Mm-hmm.
Tor gave him the option
Tor
for mercy.
Wants to give mercy.
He
when
said
possible.
No. A lady comes and says, "Hey, here's a perfectly legitimate reason not to give him mercy." And Tor's still like, "Yeah, but I really still think that's the right thing to do."
And she's like,
"And she's like, it's really not."
A little shame.
And the
you.
Knight is like, "I'm out of here." And he's like, "Oh, I can't let you go though." So he's like upset that he can't give mercy.
That honestly makes this adventure more interesting, your version, because yeah. I like Tor's adventure really didn't impress me that much.
It's,
but
I think it's just meant to be the antithesis of Gawain.
Yeah.
He's a younger knight. But he and Gawain were both just knighted.
Mm-hmm.
But Gawain was raised as royalty. So presumably he's had training. Yeah. He's had conditioning to be a knight. Whereas Tor just came from the farm.
Yeah.
Like, this guy has no training.
No.
Except maybe the couple of days that he's been a knight.
Good enough
maybe,
to beat this guy.
That maybe Pelennor was like, let me show you a thing or two.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're a chip off the old block.
Yeah.
And he's already, like, Gawain refuses mercy, and the knight he refuses to lives, and he accidentally kills a woman.
Right.
Bad.
Bad.
Tor goes out of his way to extend mercy, and at the behest of a woman, kills the knight. So it's the exact opposite.
It is, now that you point it out, yeah. Well, so, yeah, he cut off that guy's head, and the damsel's like, now, sir, it is near night. I pray you come and lodge with me here at my place. It is nearby here. So he agrees, and they rode over, and they had a pleasant time as they rode, and then they meet the damsel's husband, who's an old knight. And they also had a pleasant chat. And so he rested at their home for the night. In the morning, mass was held. They have breakfast. This is common. You have mass and breakfast. And he began to take his leave. But before he left, they wanted to know who he was. And he said, truly, my name is Surtur. I was knighted recently, and this was my first ever quest to bring the brachet that this knight Abellius took away from King Arthur's court. And the lady's like, oh, fair knight. And the husband's like, if you ever come back this way, seek us out, and you will have lodging. So Sir Tor departs. He travels for 3 days. He arrives in Camelot at noon, and the court was thrilled for his return, as aside for the horse his father Pellinore had given him and the sword and armor King Arthur had given him, he had had no other assistance and had ridden alone aside from the dwarf he met along the way. Ooh, by the way, appears to have dropped out of the narrative without explanation.
Yep.
The last mention of him was Tor handing him his glaive.
He just wasn't relevant to the narrative.
This episode is brought to you by the Greg Bush for House District 50 campaign. Greg Bush is a registered nurse, nurse's advocate, proud union member, husband, and father, who has called Columbia home for 18 years as of this May. I know him from church, and I co-starred with his wife in a Maplewood Barn production last year, The Crucible. She played Tituba. I played Reverend Hale. And now he, Greg, is running for House District 50, which is in Southern Columbia. He worked his way up the ranks at MU Healthcare and put himself through school to become a registered nurse after starting as a janitor in 2006. He's running as an advocate for patients and nurses since he's been on the front lines of watching the outcome of extremist politicians in Jeff City. He has 3 children, 1 a graduate, with 2 children still in Columbia Public Schools. He will be a fierce advocate for public education in Columbia. As a member of a working family, he already has the endorsement of 2 of the largest unions in Missouri since he's a union member and has been for nearly a decade. Check him out at Greg Bush for House District 50 on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Please consider voting for him in November. And if you can't vote for him because you don't live in House District 50, consider donating to his campaign. I have an Act Blue link that will be included in the episode description. Back to the show.
So this is another opposite to Gawain. Gawain stays in the castle where he beheaded a woman.
Yeah.
Gets captured, is kept prisoner in the castle.
Yeah.
So he still stays there.
Yeah.
And leaves bearing the body of the woman he'd murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Shameful.
Mm-hmm.
To report his crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Tor is invited a guest in the castle of the woman he helped, stays as a guest, leaves with their thanks and an invitation to come back,
yeah,
and arrives to celebration.
My version didn't specify it was a castle, but yes, I take it.
Well,
point.
We assume because the knight, the He's damsel's in... husband was a knight,
right.
So he would have had a hold, a fort, a castle of some
sure.
kind. So they're direct parallels. They both stay in the castle after the event.
Mm-hmm.
One's a prisoner, one's a guest. They leave, one in shame, one in glory. They arrive, one in shame, one in glory.
Right. So Sir Tor, as of Sir Gawain, he gets back, and the king and queen did as Merlin advised and made Sir Tor swear to tell the truth of his adventure. And so, yeah, Sir Tor did that. He told the king and the queen the events of the last 3 chapters, and the king and queen were happy to hear about it. And Merlin's like, nay, nay. This adventure is a joke compared to what he shall do in the future. He will be a noble, gentle, and courteous knight of prowess, as good as any is living, of good tatches, and he'll be true to his promises, and he'll never be outraged. What are tatches?
I don't know.
Okay.
Cool. My book does not use that specific word.
Because that came up in Balin's story as well, of good tatches.
No. Maybe it's a kind of like a feature, a trait. Hereditary thing, because I think even
maybe.
Tor's not father says, for he has no tatches of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it means he's just not like me.
Mm.
He doesn't look like me, doesn't act like me. There's nothing in him that I'm like, oh, that's a family trait, you know?
I don't know.
He doesn't have our eyes, that kind of thing.
But yeah, so King Arthur was so impressed by Merlin's words, he gave Sir Tor an earldom of his lands.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That ain't bad.
And here endeth the quest of Sir Tor. King Pellinore's son. So yeah, I mean, I don't know there's much else to say about that. Like you said, it's pretty much the antithesis of Gawain's adventure.
I think comparatively, Pellinore's adventure is a little bit shorter.
It is.
There's not as much development. It's pretty straightforward.
It is. Yeah, he just He does the thing.
He kind of just shows back. Up, is like, I'm gonna do the thing, and then he leaves, and he did the thing, and you're like, oh, good.
That's why I wasn't really all that impressed by it. Yeah. But like your mentioning of like the differences in yours versus mine kind of actually makes it more significant, because like it really, your version really drives home how much he didn't want to kill the guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but mine, it was just kind of like he relented a little bit, but eventually he was like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't have to chase the guy down.
Right.
Chapter 12. How King Pellinore rode after the lady and the knight that led her away, and how a lady desired help of him, and how he fought with two knights for that lady, of whom he slew the one at the first stroke.
So, much like the two knights before him, King Pellinore armed himself, mounted his horse, and rode more than a pace after the lady that the knight led away. He rode through a forest, and as he traveled through the forest, he went through a valley where he saw a damsel sitting by a well with a wounded knight in her arms. Pellinore saluted her. When the lady became aware of King Pellinore, she cried out to him, "Help me, knight! For Christ's sake, King Pellinore, help me!" This phrase struck out to me because "for Christ's sake" is a very modern phrase. I didn't realize they used it back then.
Yeah. They've been using it for a long time.
Yeah. Today I learned. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so King Pellinore did not stop. He was already on his quest. He said, no side quests today. No, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Kept on his way.
He's speed running the main quest.
So the lady cried out for help 100 times after he passed by. Nobody stopped to help her. And when it became clear to her that help would not come, she prayed to God that her knight would get as much help as she had called for and that he might get it or die. Well, as it would happen, the knight did indeed die, and the lady then killed herself with his sword for sorrow of his death.
Mm-hmm.
Not that King Pellinore finds out about that until later. Yeah. So
very similar to the occurrence with Balin, mm-hmm. where he refused to stop the woman
mm-hmm.
from committing suicide.
Yeah, so Pellinore rides on. Further along in the valley, he came across a poor man, a laborer. He asked the man, "You wouldn't have happened to have seen a knight on horseback hauling a lady with him, would you?" And the laborer, I picture a guy 10 years off from being Grandpa Simpson.
Yep.
So this guy, he's like, "Yeah, I did. I saw that knight. And that lady was screaming like you wouldn't believe. And down yonder, below the valley, you'll see two pavilions. One of the knights of the pavilions challenged that knight with the lady, said she was his cousin, and that he would lead her no further. And so they fought a bit, and then the other knight of the pavilions wanted to know what all the ruckus was about. And the first knight said that he would have her by force. And the knight of the pavilion said nay, she was his cousin, and he would take her back to her family. So then those two knights started fighting each other again, and the other knight of the pavilions, I suppose he didn't think getting involved was worth the trouble. So he left her there with the squires. So, yeah, if you ride a pace that way, you'll find them fighting still. The lady is with the squires still." And King Pellinore, I imagine he was bemused at this story. He says, "God thank thee," and heads on his way.
Like, man, this couldn't be easier.
Yeah.
She's right over there.
So then he, and I'm quoting this because it just sounds so silly, then he rode a wallop until he found the pavilions. And as the workman had said, there were two knights fighting and a lady with two squires. I imagine the squires were very confused about this turn of events.
Yeah, they're just like, I guess
this is happening.
I guess you got to stay with us, ma'am. I don't, until they figure this out, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Pellinore, he approaches the lady, and he says, "Fair lady, you must go with me back to the court of King Arthur." "Sir knight," one of the two squires says, "yonder are two knights that fight for this lady. Go to them and end their fighting, and if they agree that she may go with you, then you may have her at your pleasure." I don't like the implications of that, at your pleasure.
I think you're reading connotation into it
a little too modern.
Because of who Pellinore is.
That's also fair.
The squires have no idea.
You're right.
They're just like, if that's what you want and they agree, cool.
Yeah.
But given his sordid past, we're like, hey, don't giving this guy just ladies and saying, whatever you want, man.
Whatever you want.
It's probably not smart.
Yeah. So Pelennor is like, you say well. And then he rode between the two knights fighting, broke up the fight. He's like, why are you fighting? Which, by the way, I love that this keeps happening. Like, just anytime there's two knights fighting, knights gotta, the other knights, yeah, they gotta like, whoa, get involved, whoa, 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 and break it up. Whoa, whoa.
What's going on?
Yeah. Hey. Hey.
Well, I mean, like when Gawain stopped it, if it's a stupid reason, you'd be like, all right, idiots, knock it off. You guys are dumb. Shut up. Go to King
We're
Arthur.
Brothers.
Tell him I sent you.
We're brothers. Like, yes,
that's
but
a
why?
Stupid reason. That's not an answer. The reason that triggers me so much is so many times when my mom would stop us from fighting, she'd be like, why are you fighting? We'd be like, I couldn't even tell you. I don't know.
I don't know.
Because he's my brother. And she's like, that's stupid. Stop it.
It is stupid. Like, So he breaks up the fight. And the knight of the pavilion tells Pelennor that the lady is his aunt's daughter. And that when I heard her complain he was with this man against her will, I waged battle to fight with him. The knight who stole the lady, whose name was Hanslake of Wetland, he said, Sir Knight, this lady I gat by my prowess of arms this day at Arthur's court. And King Pelennor, he's like, that is untruly said. You came in there suddenly as we were at the high feast and took away this lady before any man could make ready to challenge you. It is my quest to bring her back, and you as well, or else we must fight over it. Therefore, the lady shall go with me, or I will die for it. As I have promised King Arthur, it will be done. Therefore, fight no more, for none of you shall have anything to do with this lady at this time. If you insist on fighting for her, fight with me, and I will defend her. That's the most he said this whole story.
Mm-hmm. And probably the most charitable thing he said.
It's true. So, naturally, the knights wanted to fight.
Yeah.
So, Hanslake of Wetland, he wanted to fight dirty. He took his sword and drove it through Pelennor's horse and said, now you are on foot as well as we are. When Pelennor realized his horse was dying, he nimbly dismounted, drew his sword, shield at the ready, and he's like, knight, protect your head. For you shall have a buffet for the slaying of my horse. And then he brought his sword down so strongly on Hanslake's head that he split his head down to the chin and his body fell down dead. End of chapter.
And you know what? That's what that guy fucking deserves.
Fucking A right.
Kidnapped.
Like it's so camp, right? It reminds me of those robbers that would like steal ladies and like stick them on train tracks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The little hostage.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, I got you now.
And that's what Hans like reminds me of.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. I'm sure he had a thin twist and handlebar mustache too. I guarantee it. Guarantee it. Or maybe a little French goatee.
Right. Chapter 13.
How King Pelennor gat the lady and brought her to Camelot to the court of King Arthur.
So, after killing this knight with one strike, he turned to the knight of the pavilions. This knight was already pretty wounded from his battle with Hanslake, so rather than fight, he knelt. He said, take my cousin the lady with you at your request, but I require you, as you are a true knight, to put her to no shame nor villainy. And King Pelennor is like, what? Will you not fight for her? And he's like, no, sir. I will not fight with such a knight of prowess as you. And he's like, well, okay, then.
Yeah. Fair enough.
All right.
And you know what? It's a good deal for the cousin. He's like, wait, this guy's pretty strong. Hey, if you promise you're not going to, like, do anything creepy, you can just take her.
Right.
And he's like, really?
Okay. Cool.
That's a good deal.
So he's like, I promise you that she shall have no villainy by me, as I am true knight. I thought that wording was a little weird. Like, I am true knight. But now I lack a horse. I will have Hanslake's horse. And the knight of the pavilion says, you shall not need it, for I shall give you a horse that shall please you. I do this so that you will lodge with me, as it is near night. And King Pelennor is like, okay, I'll stay with you for the night.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey, I'll give you a horse if you come sleep over at my house. It sounds like a good deal all around.
Right?
You're giving me two things?
Okay, cool.
Done.
So they had good cheer and drank wine and had a good night's sleep. And in the morning, they had mass and breakfast. And the knight brought King Pelennor a fair bay courser with his saddle already set upon it. Now, what shall I call you? The knight of the pavilions asked, seeing as you have my cousin at your desire of your quest. Sir, I shall tell you, my name is King Pellinore of the Isles, and Knight of the Table Round. Now I am glad, said the knight, that such a noble man shall have the rule of my cousin. Now what is your name? Pellinore asked. I pray you tell me. Sir, my name is Sir Meliot of Logures, and this lady is my cousin Nemue. And the knight that was in the other pavilion is my sworn brother Brian of the Isles. He hates to do wrong, and hates to fight any man, unless he is sought to fight. King Pellinore is like, it is a marvel that he will not fight with me. And, Meliot, he's like, sir, he will not fight any man unless he is asked to. Bring him to the court one of these days. Sir, we will come together, and you shall be welcome. And so Pellinore and the Lady Nemue, they departed for Camelot. And they came across a valley full of stones. So there, the lady's horse stumbled on the stones and threw her down. And she swooned with pain. She was like, my arm is out of life. Which I take to mean either it's broken or the joint is out of its socket. Mm-hmm. One of the two. So, she's complaining about her arm and she says she must rest.
She's got a dead arm. That's what she's like, I can't move it.
I must rest. And he's like, you shall well. This feels like a catchphrase. Like, you say well, you shall well. Mm-hmm. Like, he just keeps saying it. So they rested under a nice tree where there was nice grass, and he put his horse there too. And he laid under the tree until it was night. And when he woke up, he was ready to ride again. But the lady, she's like, sir, it is so dark that you may as well ride backward as forward. Seems pretty sensible.
Won't know which way we're going.
Right. So they remained under the tree. Pellinore took off his armor and made proper camp. Then around midnight, they heard a trotting horse. Stay still, he said, for we shall hear of some adventure.
Chapter 14. How on the way he heard two knights, as he lay by night in a valley, and of their adventures.
Pellinore armed himself in case things went sideways, but he and the lady remained hidden. Two knights on horseback, one coming from Camelot and one coming from the north, saluted each other. What tidings at Camelot? By my head, I have been there and seen the court of King Arthur. There be such a fellowship that may never break, for there is the flower of chivalry. For this reason, I am riding north to tell our chieftains of the fellowship that is beholden to King Arthur. As for that, the other knight said, I have brought a remedy with me to the greatest poison that you've ever seen. I ride to Camelot with it, for we have a friend near King Arthur, well known and cherished, that shall poison him. He has promised our chieftain so, and received great gifts to do it. Beware of Merlin, said the knight from Camelot, for he knows all things by the devil's craft. Then I shall. And then the knights departed. And then Pellinore and the lady readied for travel and rode for Camelot. I'm not sure if they left right then or waited until morning. The narrative doesn't really...
Yeah, I don't think mine specifies either.
Yeah, I don't think it matters that much. So on their way, they come across a wounded knight and lady that Pellinore ignored, and he was anguished to discover that they were both dead and their bodies ripped apart and eaten by wild animals, except for the lady's head. King Pellinore wept at the sight. He was like, alas! I might have saved her life, but I was so fierce in my quest and I didn't help them. And Lady Nemue, he's like, why do you cry like this? And he's like, I wouldn't, but my heart mourns for the death of her. She was a fair lady and so young. Lady Nemue considers, and she says, will you take my advice? Take this knight and have him buried in a hermitage. Take the lady's head and show it to King Arthur. So Pellinore hefted the knight's body on his shoulders, brought it to a hermitage, passing the body's care to a hermit, and offering the body's harness as payment. That's the end of that chapter. So I'm trying to figure out the significance of everything that's going on in this chapter. So we get these two knights just chatting about the situation. Like, oh, hey, the knights of the round table. Oh, hey, there's this guy that's trying to poison King Arthur. I'm bringing an antidote for that.
No, he's bringing the poison.
He's bringing the poison?
It's phrased weirdly, but he is bringing the poison that this spy is supposed to use to kill Arthur.
Aha. Okay, that makes more
sense. Now, in my version, when he says, like, hey, beware Merlin, like, you know, he can see the future and all that stuff. You need to watch out for him. The other guy responds with, "I do not fear Merlin."
Okay. Which maybe seems, I just misunderstood.
Which seems cocky.
Yeah.
But I don't know at what point that does become relevant, but I do think it comes back up.
Interesting. Because, yeah, they don't mention it again in this story.
No, it does not come back up again.
Yeah.
But, and even if it didn't, I think the narrative function would just be like, it seems like it's peaceful now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, all that's going on right now are quests. And this is a way to, like, in the background be like, no, there's still people that, like, hate Arthur. That don't like him.
Going down.
Like, there's still other problems out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to focus in too much on these small events to forget that, like, big picture, Arthur, like, conquers the world. Like, and people are very resistant to that.
Yeah.
And so there's still groups of people out there that are like, can we kill Arthur somehow?
I mean, like, he's still, like, a teenager, maybe early 20s at this point.
Yeah.
So, makes sense. Anyways, moving on to the final chapter.
Chapter 15. How, when he was come to Camelot, he was sworn upon a book to tell the truth of his quest.
So, I should mention that there was actually no mention of a book in the narrative. I don't know why it says that.
So, there is.
Okay.
But it's interesting that they just say that he's to swear on a book, because he's swearing on the book, which is the Bible.
Okay.
And it's only come up previously, I believe, in the Gawain, where in your book it says he had to swear on the four evangelists.
Yes.
Those are the four Gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Oh, so it did mention it then.
Yes.
It
so in my book, it says he swears on the Gospels.
It says he swears upon the four evangelists in my version. Okay. Yes,
that's he's swearing on the Gospels of the Bible.
Okay.
And so now when it's bringing up in this one, it's they make him swear on a book. It's weird that he says a book.
Yeah.
As opposed to like the book or some other way that would be more obvious.
Hmm.
But the only book that they would swear on
was the Bible.
Would be the Bible.
Right. So they leave the hermitage. They return for the lady's head. It hurt Pelennor to look at it because it had pretty blonde hair, and he loved blonde hair. So by noon that day, they returned to Camelot. His quest was very short compared to the other two.
Yes.
So he, you know, he returns to Camelot, and the king and queen, they're happy at his return, and like the other two knights in the story, he was sworn to tell the truth of his adventures. And Queen Guinevere, she's like, "Ah, Sir Pelennor, you are greatly to blame that you did not save this lady's life." And he said, "Madam, you would be greatly to blame if you would not save your own life, and you might, but save your pleasure. I was so focused on my quest that I would not aid her, and I regret this, and shall truly regret this all the days of my life." So now we get quite a monologue from Merlin here. So Merlin, he says, "Truly, you do sorely regret this, for that lady was your own daughter that you bore with the Lady of the Rule, and that knight with her was her lover and would have married her. He was a right good knight, a young man, and would have proved himself a good man. He was coming to this court, and his name was Sir Miles of the Lawns. A knight came behind him with a spear. That knight's name was Lorraine Le Savage, a false knight and a coward. That lady whose head you carry, her name was Elaine, and she slew herself with great sorrow because you did not help her. You shall see your best friend fail you when you find yourself in the greatest distress that you have ever or ever shall be. That penance God has ordained you for your deed, that he who you shall trust more than any other man living, that man shall leave you when you need him, and you will die." So he just lays it all out there. He's like, "You have no idea how bad you fucked up, and now I'm telling you."
Mm-hmm. Not only was it a helpless maiden in distress, it was your own daughter. So the interesting thing I find about Pelennor is the sort of unstated character development as he goes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he felt no pity for this woman on the way out to the quest.
Right.
Does the quest. I think it's sort of implied that this other knight that, like, yields to him, the cousin of Nimue,
mm-hmm.
is a good influence on him.
Oh, you think so?
in that he's seeing like, oh, this is how like a knight that actually cares about a woman treats that woman.
Mm.
And then when he leaves, he comes back and now he's realizing, I was like, oh man, I really could have helped her.
I could have saved this lady.
Like, now that I'm thinking more clearly, if I care about women, I would have helped. Mm-hmm. I should have stopped to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So then he gets back and he's like, I'm really sorry I didn't do it. Like, I'm going to regret it. I know that what I did was wrong.
And then Merlin rubs salt in the wound.
Right. And then Merlin's like, yeah, you fucking will. And so I think it's that, like, Gawain is this all bad story. Mm-hmm. They're like, it's all bad. He did everything wrong, mm-hmm. except maybe stopping the fight between the two brothers. Like, that might be the only thing he did right.
Right.
Everything else, shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tor does everything right.
Yeah.
You're like, he nailed it. Everyone's like, hell yeah. Every decision was a good one. Tor, you're the guy.
Yeah.
And then Pelennor is this, like, 50-50.
Yeah.
They're like, you really fucked up in the beginning.
He did the quest, but he ignored the side quest.
Yeah. It's like, you really should have stopped and done something, but you did do the ultimate thing. Like, he kept his word. He didn't do anything weird to the lady.
Uh-uh.
Like, protected her, kept her safe.
Yeah.
Got her to the court. Everything was fine. But it's like, there's some room for improvement here, bud.
Yeah.
You really could work on some of these things.
And Merlin's like, you're cursed now. And Pelennor is when Merlin's like, you know, the man that you trust more than any other man will leave you when you need him and you shall die. King Pelennor, he's like, I don't think that'll happen. But, you know, God ordains my destiny.
See, and that's more of the 50-50 where he's like, I don't believe what you're telling me is true. Like, mm-hmm. Merlin, I think you're lying.
Yeah.
That's bad. You should trust Merlin. Merlin mm-hmm. doesn't lie to you.
Mm-hmm.
Except in disguising himself. Or if you're King Lot. Mm-hmm. But other than that, Merlin doesn't lie to you. So, like, mistake. But to the point where he's like, but, you know, God ordains my destiny. It's like, okay, that's good. He's accepting that whatever happens will happen.
Yeah.
He's just like, Merlin's full of shit.
Yeah. So when all three of these quests were completed, King Arthur gathered all of his knights and gave lands to those that didn't have lands already. And then he ordered them all to never be outrageous in actions, nor murder, nor be treasonous, to never be cruel, and to always grant mercy to those who ask it. And never to break these orders, or else they would be forsaken by King Arthur forevermore. Also, always help ladies, damsels, and gentlewomen, or be punished by death. Also, do no battles that would break the law, nor for no world's goods.
Yeah, so mine ends with basically saying, and, you know, thus was established the Knights of the Round Table that operate under these, like, precepts, and it was... never act without just cause.
Right.
Always show mercy to those who ask for it,
mm-hmm.
and put the service of ladies above all.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yours,
I mean, that's
a little more concise.
Yeah. And that's what these three stories are.
Yeah.
You know, Gawain acted unjustly. The guy asked for mercy.
Yeah.
You didn't need to strike at him.
Yeah.
He did not show mercy to those that asked for it.
Yeah.
And he did not put the service of ladies above others. So he did everything wrong. Tor did not act unless he had just cause. He didn't kill that guy until he was like, oh, this guy's a real piece of shit.
Okay, I'll kill him.
He did show mercy when the guy asked for it until the lady was like, no, 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 you
No, the guy didn't ask for mercy.
Well, that's
he
true.
Was like,
he
yield, and he was like, no.
Yeah. But afterwards, he was like, and he's like, I'm kind of, my hands are tied here.
Listen,
like,
I would have.
I want to, but I can't.
Yeah.
So he was still willing to show the mercy. And he put the service of the woman above everything else, mm-hmm. even above his own desire for mercy.
Yeah.
And then Pelennor did not help that woman.
No.
That was, I would say, he wasn't acting unjustly. He just failed to act justly.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sin by inaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but when he gets to his actual quest, he does act justly in defeating the knight that kidnapped Nimue. He then acts justly and shows mercy to the knight who refuses to fight him.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts his charge, the damsel, above all others on the return quest.
I think he's also a little bit influenced, now that you mention it, by learning of this guy, Brian, who won't fight anyone unless they demand to fight him.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, that's probably a good example. Maybe I should do that. So I like the three stories because you have the two extremes and then that sort of middle ground where it's like, this is the absolute worst. This is the ideal. Here's that realistic middle ground where, like, you're going to do things that you regret and you're going to fuck up.
Well, the interesting thing there is Gawain and Tor are new knights, and Pelennor has been doing this for a while.
Right.
So it kind of makes sense that you would have these extremes with the new knights.
Yeah, and then you have that sort of morally gray, experienced knight that's like, I didn't do everything right.
Yeah.
I got the main goal done. I did some of it right. But yeah, I could have done some things better.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's really where most of us are going to find ourselves. Most of us, not in that we are rapists. That is not what I'm saying. Most of us are King Pelennor.
Yes.
Because most people, they're not Gawain.
Most people are neutral.
You're not an evil rage monster. Most people, as much as we strive, will not be Tor. No. We are not going to be perfect. We're going to be Pelennor. We're going to be somewhere where we're like, we got what we wanted to do done, but maybe we wish we'd have done it a little differently, mm-hmm. or wished for a slightly different outcome, or that mm-hmm. we had done something else along the way. That's what I took away from the stories. It's like, of the Knights of the Round Table, you have guys that really got a lot of shit to learn. You've got guys that got it figured out, and it's not necessarily the most experienced, but most of them are going to fall in that middle ground where they're trying, but it's not always going to work out.
Yeah. So my version of the story, it ends with, you know, they were charged with these oaths that Arthur wanted them to make. They made them, and annually at the Feast of Pentecost, they would renew their oaths. Mm-hmm. So endeth this story.
Yeah.
Of the wedding of King Arthur and Queen Guinevere.
Yeah. The one last thing I want to say, and this is in relation to the Round Table. The significance of the fact that the table is round is that there's no head of the table.
Right.
There's no center. There's no one. Like, Arthur sits at the table. He is not the most important person at the table. They all sit equally. That's kind of the whole point. Most people know that, but I feel like we got to touch on that just in case.
Yeah, it should be worth mentioning.
To be like,
sure.
Hey, the round table is established. The whole point is nobody's necessarily in charge.
Yeah.
All knights are equal. The only thing that could be seen as the exception is Siege Perilous.
Right.
But since right now that sits empty, there's still no head. Like, mm-hmm. the idea is that one day there will be a knight so virtuous and so magnanimous that he could occupy the Siege Perilous. But that knight does not yet exist or is not known to anybody.
So I'm sure you already know who that is, but I don't. So I'm going to make some guesses.
Mm-hmm.
It is either Galahad or Percival. That is my guess.
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Okay, we're going to wrap up. I've got places to be. So I want to thank Chris D. Mooney for being our audio recordist. He set everything up. He is the guy in the chair making sure the audio is good while we do this. Thank you, Zach, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And for contributing your symbolism. I think that's valuable. And just color commentary. Thank you, VidWest, for providing us the bulk of our equipment and for a space that we can use to just record everything. Thank you, Jake Weller, for our music. He's the one that does our intro, our outro, and our chapter. So I hope you guys enjoy that. Bye, guys.
Bye.